Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit, both now and ever, and into age of ages. Amen. In honor of the coming great feast of Orthodoxy Sunday, or the Triumph of Orthodoxy, that we'll be celebrating this coming Sunday, I thought it would be a nice way to celebrate that and prepare everyone for it by having a little Bible study on a subject that is related to the feast. And that is, what does the Bible say about this subject of religious imagery? There's a lot of confusion out there about it. Before we get into that, though, I thought it'd be good to have just a little bit of quick summary background about what we're doing this Sunday, why we're going to do it, and then why is this Bible study relevant? So first of all, you know, Exodus chapter 20, verse 4, God says in his Ten Commandments to Moses, you shall not make, fill in the blank, depends on what translation you have, graven images or idols, whatever you've got there, and bow down and worship them. We'll get back to that text in a second. That was just a summary. And there's a lot of confusion about that. In fact, what happened was, even though the Jews were not confused about this, the early Christians were not confused about this, Mohammedans were confused about this. Muhammad, who knew very little about Judaism and Christianity, but knew an awful lot about his own local pagan religions, created a new religion called Islam. I'm sure I'll be put in jail for this eventually. Created a new religion called Islam, and which has very little to do with Islam, a little to do with peace, of course. But in this new religion, there are a number of heresies that he created. Hilaire Belloc wrote a great little book called The Ten Great Heresies. In there, he includes, in those ten great heresies, Islam. It really is a Christian heresy if you study it carefully. It's an offshoot of confusion regarding Judaism and Christianity, and then the kind of organization into a finally a religion that took over in many parts of the known world at that time. Okay, so Muhammad, among many of his confusions about Christianity and Judaism, he was illiterate. He couldn't read the scriptures of Christianity or Judaism. But his hearing of it and understanding of the Hebrew scriptures regarding the Ten Commandments led to a misunderstanding on his part, which eventually manifests itself also with Calvin, John Calvin, a future reformer in the Protestant Revolution. Muhammad heard in the Ten Commandments that the Jews would recite to him what he thought was a condemnation of religious imagery, and in fact, for him, really just about any imagery. But for what we're talking about tonight, we're going to focus on this subject of religious imagery most importantly. And as a result of that, and his conquest and his followers' conquest of the Eastern Mediterranean and North Africa shortly thereafter, Christianity, through apologetic debates and, you know, bumping heads with their local Muslims, began to absorb the same heresy called iconoclasm. That is, the idea that religious imagery should not be allowed, it's prohibited by God, and therefore must be destroyed. Iconoclasm comes from a Greek word meaning icon or image smashing. And the Muslims would do this. They would take over a church, take all the religious imagery out of it, destroy it, and if it was on the walls, they would just paint over it. You probably know about Hagia Sophia, the great church of Constantinople, that was actually preserved as a result of this due to their plastering over of the ancient icons. And only recently, some of those icons began to be revealed under the Turkish government with it becoming a museum. Now, unfortunately, it's become a mosque again. So, but as a result of them plastering over things on the walls and getting rid of this imagery, we have still preserved for us these beautiful ancient icons. Who knows what tomorrow will bring regarding that? Christianity, influenced by their debates with their local Muslim brethren, began to fall into this heresy as well. And many, even clergy, priests, deacons, bishops, began to remove imagery from the churches and destroy it and condemn the making of any future imagery. This is all due to Muhammad's misunderstanding of the Ten Commandments. We'll get to that in a second. It was the same exact mistake that Calvin made later on, about 1,000 years later. And many Protestants following Calvin still today. But we'll talk about that in a second. Okay, so in 787, the seventh and great and final ecumenical council of the church condemned this heresy. We don't have time to get into all the details tonight, but if I would recommend highly, go online. If you don't have the documents of the seven ecumenical councils, go online, Google Seventh Ecumenical Council, and read the beautiful declaration of the Holy Fathers of the Seventh Ecumenical Council against the error of iconoclasm. We'll talk, as we read the scriptures regarding this subject, about what they were saying and why they said what they said. But to see their beautiful words, I recommend highly for you to read them as well. Okay, this Sunday we're going to be celebrating the Feast of the Triumph of Orthodoxy, which is also called the Triumph of the Holy Icons, which is really its main kind of root. But in the end, it really is, as the fathers saw in the Seventh Council, the triumph of the Orthodox faith, that is, of the understanding that God has become man and that matter is actually good. He made it good and it must be restored to its goodness. It must be restored to it. It's not to be rejected. Matter is not evil. Flesh is not evil. That's dualism. The idea of spirit good, flesh evil, spirit good, matter evil. That's all dualism. That's heresy. That's satanic. No, everything was good, right? Remember that. Everything was good. Genesis 1. So when something is good and is broken, it's in need of being restored, being fixed. This is why we hold to the resurrection of our bodies. Our body, salvation is not flying off into the clouds, right? Escape from this material world, escape from our bodies to play the harp with angels for all eternity. That is absolute heresy. We may die before Christ returns, but we will be brought back. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, with him, he will bring us back and raise our bodies from the dead. And as St. Paul says in his first letter to the Corinthians, we will be judged in what we have done in these bodies. And the wicked shall go to the lake of fire, this is the other book of Revelation, in their bodies, and the righteous in their bodies shall remain and experience a new heaven, a new earth, and the new Garden of Eden, the new Jerusalem, and God will dwell with man. Not man dwells God, God dwells with man. The Garden of Eden restored. You have been in these Bible studies, have heard this probably many times, said, okay, please move on to another subject. You've talked about it before. I know, but there might be some new ones that might want to hear that. Okay, so this is intimately related to the subject tonight. This is what the Holy Fathers of the Seventh Council said. You destroy the icons, and you destroy the mystery of the incarnation. You reject the goodness of matter, which was created by God, and which God took as his own flesh. And through that flesh and matter, saved us who are both spirit and flesh. and saved both, right? You, we may be saved through your baptism in spirit, but you will be saved through the resurrection in your body. Okay, now, in March 11th, 843, March 11th, another synod was held. So this is almost a half a century later here, more than a half century later. Another synod was held to enforce the council's declaration. And when that declaration finally happened in 843, March 11, 843, the fathers of the synod council announced in the streets, and everybody went out to their houses and gathered the holy images, the icons, from their beds, under their beds and hidden in the closets and everywhere they had them, and brought them back into the churches in great procession, down the streets, from their houses, into the churches, and putting them back on the walls, knowing that they were finally now safe. That event happened. It ended up that year. It was the first Sunday of Great Lent. And so from that day until today, from the year 843 until now, Eastern Christians have continued to celebrate this great event on the first Sunday of the Great Fast, called the Triumph of Orthodoxy. Glorious feast. Hopefully you'll be with us this Sunday. If you're not, I hope you'll be in some Eastern Christian church where you can properly celebrate this. Now, that's the history. Let's get now to the issues that are often today confusing for people. And that is, what does the Bible really say about this? Why was Muhammad confused? Why did John Calvin take over churches in the West and do what Muhammad did? Cleanse them of imagery. While Luther screamed, please don't do that. Luther and Calvin disagreed on this. Why do we walk into a Protestant church today and find statues and beautiful stained glass in a nice Lutheran church or Anglican church? And you walk into another Protestant church, a Baptist church or something, and it's white walls. And if you're lucky, you might find a cross, but certainly no corpus on it. Nothing, no imagery, nothing, nothing. And often sometimes they will not even have a cross. What's going on there? Well, those are the two different strains, primary strains of Protestantism. Lutheranism, Calvinism. There's also some Zwinglianism there, but we can't get all these details tonight. Now, where is this all coming from? Well, it all comes from a misread, Muhammad's misread, Calvin's misread, and many Christians today's misread of Exodus chapter 20. So let's turn there, if you open up your Bibles, to Exodus chapter 20. Exodus chapter 20. This is Moses is at Mount Sinai. He's receiving the Ten Commandments. And God spoke all these words, saying, I am Yahweh your God. Notice all caps. If you're English Bible there, you've got all caps. That's in the Hebrew there, it's Yahweh, that's my name. I am Yahweh, your God. Underline the word your. He didn't say, I am Yahweh God. Notice that. Notice the your. Possessive pronoun. Your God, right? He's not the God of the Egyptians. He's not the God of the Canaanites. He's your God. I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. I'm the one that did it. Of course he's the one that did it, right? No, it's not that clear for them. They're a bunch of stinking polytheists. They've been in Egypt for 400 years. So it's not quite clear to them who actually did this. What, didn't they listen to Moses? No, they never listened to Moses, okay? So didn't they remember the 10 plagues? Well, not so clearly. Could you imagine being in Egypt during that time? We read it nicely. Oh, 10 plagues, right? Can you imagine the chaos, the economic chaos of the situation? people dying everywhere, animals dying, crops are destroyed. There were 10 plagues, yes, but total destruction of the country. From the Israelites' perspective, there was a massive disaster in Egypt. They left Egypt following this guy named Moses, who says that the God of their ancestors was speaking to him. They cross the Red Sea. They get to Mount Sinai. And now he goes up on the mountain and he comes back down and he delivers to them God's commandments, the contract, right? Are you going to sign up to this contract? If you do, then we're going to get along. Here's the contract. Here are the stipulations of the contract. I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no gods before me. Why do you have to say that? Because they're stinking polytheists, okay? They've been in Egypt for 400 years. They know nothing else but worshiping pagan gods in the form of, as we're going to see in the next verse, pagan idols. The Egyptians had many, many gods. I don't know how many they had, 15, 20 main gods at least. You know of one of them, the golden calf. That's an image of the god Apis. The god Hecht. Many, many gods. The god Re, the god of the sun. Many, many gods. The huge pantheon of gods. Okay, so they've been there for 400 years. They walk like Egyptians. They talk like Egyptians. They worship like Egyptians. So God has to be very clear to them. I am the one that brought you out of Egypt. And you shall have no other gods. This is a monotheistic system, no polytheism. And then following upon that, the next line, you shall not make for yourself a graven image. Now, I have an RSV here. Graven image there. It's a really bad translation. There could be worse, but that's not representative of what's in the text, really. Graven is Old English. Have you ever used the word graven on the street? You're walking down the street and you say, hey, I'd like to have that graven image there. Or you're in a museum and they're selling some artwork. And you say, how much for that graven image? No, you don't, because it's not modern English. We don't even say that. Our English Bibles are total disasters because we hate to have modern English in our Bibles. We like it to sound churchy the way grandma, had. Well, that's a disaster because then we don't even know what we're saying. Great grandma had vocabulary that we don't have anymore. You remember when you were a kid, great grandma would say stuff and you didn't know what she was talking about? Okay. Well, these Bibles are often great, 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 great grandma's English. And so even a modern Bible, you say, oh, this is a fresh new English translation. I'll find you archaic forms in there. Everyone wants it to sound churchy, which for them means how grandma had it, or how they remember it as a kid. Okay. So graven image. That's not what it says. It says image. And we'll talk about that word image in a second, the translation of the word image and what really is going on in there in Hebrew and the Greek in a second. But let's just throw in the word image there for a second. Or any likeness or anything that is in the heavens above or in the earth beneath or there's the water under there. So three realms, sky, the dirt, and the water. Basically, you could put in there, you can't make an image of anything. Sky, the earth, or in the water, right? Birds, sun, moon, stars, the sky, on the earth, bull calves, okay? Alligator, whatever you want, something run, a lion, under the earth, in the waters under the earth. That is whales, crocodiles, stuff like that. They thought these things were gods as well. So you cannot make an image of any of these things. It says, you shall not bow down to them or serve them. Now, notice what that is talking about there in that next verse. You shall not, look at verse 5. You shall not bow down or serve them. What is that condemnation of in verse 5? It's a condemnation of pagan idolatry. Now let's go up to verse 1. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. That's monotheism versus polytheism. You shall have no other gods before me. What is that? Monotheism versus polytheism. What do you think verse 4 is all about? Context. Well, unfortunately, Muhammad heard this out of context and thought it was a condemnation of religious imagery, the making of religious imagery. John Calvin also read it that way, as a condemnation of the making of religious imagery. That is not the way it has been read historically by Jews, by Christians, but tragically, within Christianity, there were two moments when this text has been misread out of context. During the time of Muhammad and his followers, during the time of the iconoclastic heresy, a century Christianity, in the East, where Islamic influences were felt. And then later on in the West, under John Calvin's misread of the text. Two periods of iconoclasm, of image smashing, due to a misread of this verse, verse 4. What they read verse 4 as was a condemnation of the making of religious imagery. Altogether, the whole thing, any kind of religious imagery. Walk into a mosque, you're not going to find a picture of Muhammad. Okay, so now, but we got to read these things in context, right? We put it back in its context. Let's put it back in its literary context. Let's put it back in its historical context. The people of Israel have come out of Egypt, a place of polytheism and idolatry. God has taken them out of polytheistic, idolatrous Egypt to bring them to the promised land. So there he can begin through them to bring all of the nations back into the kingdom of God to worship the one true God, rather than the worship of these false gods in the form of all these idols. That's the historical context. It's the, he's fulfilling the call of Abraham, right? These descendants of Abraham had failed. They went back into the nations. He brought Abraham from the nations to this land, and they went back into the nations. So now he's got to bring them back out so they can do it again, so they can do what they're supposed to do. They never really did it, but that was the purpose. Okay, so now, that's the historical context. Now they're at Mount Sinai. Literary context. Verse 4 is couched in verses 1, 2, and 3 in front of it, and verse 5 and 6 after it. If you look at the verses before and after verse 4, you can see that verse 4 is sitting in the center of a bunch of anti-polytheistic, anti-idolatrous, anti-pagan statements. Now, either verse 4 is one of those things that's not like the other one, like on the electric company, or verse 4 is related to everything around it. You may say, well, Father Sebastian, that's perfectly logical. Of course it's related. It's got to be related to what's around it, right? Well, nobody ever reads these things in context. Nobody really thinks about this. They'll quote some verse, and then they're off to the races. Everything must be understood in context. It's literary context. It's historical context. Who was the author? Who was the intended audience? Moses, Israel, Mount Sinai? Okay. So there's two ways to read this. Either verse 4 is completely taken out of context and simply a statement against religious imagery. And then all this, the verses before and after are about another subject that is against idolatry and paganism. Or verse 4 is actually part of a whole passage, which of course is much more logical, that is about God teaching the people of Israel not to worship pagan gods and many gods, and especially not in the form of idols. Now, When you look at the text, before we move from this text, there's a little more information we need to look at, and that is, what does the word actually say there in verse 4? I mentioned graven images. Graven image in the RSV coming from the King James, I believe. And the King James, I think, is getting it from the Douay Rheims there. Graven image. Graven is an old English word meaning carved. It's the same Indo-European root. In fact, by the way, if this is your first time logging in or you're not familiar with Zoom, if you go on speaker view up in the right corner, you'll be able to see my screen better here. Otherwise, you won't be able to see anything I'm about to write on the board. Okay, so graven, the root is G-R-V. Grav, grav. You can even hear it there. Grav. Carve, C-R-V. Carve, C, this is a G-C interchange in Old English. Carved image. You can go look it up in a dictionary. Graven. Okay, again, we don't use it in English today, modern, it's Old English. Look it up in a dictionary, you'll see it. It means carved. Okay, it's the same word. It doesn't just mean carved, it is carved. That's the word. The modern form of this word is carved. The relics of this old root with the G, we still have in the word grave. Something you dig out or engrave, to engrave something, to carve, to scrape out. Okay, but this study is not so much about English words. Okay, so the word in, so graven image means carved image, modern English, carved image. That's okay, however, it doesn't really explain what's being said here. In fact, if God's condemning here the making of carved images, we've got a major problem in a second, as we'll see. Okay, now, the word here in Hebrew, in verse 4, this is verse 4, okay, pesel. Pesel in Hebrew. I'll write it on the board for you if you like. For those of you who want to see some Hebrew words for fun. Chalk here. So, pesel pesel. This is a Hebrew word that means image. Okay, some of you might, who are logged in tonight might know a little Arabic, so you might know the root. You might be familiar with this root, pesel. Means image, okay? But it's not the only word in Hebrew for image. Think of how many times image, God made man his image and likeness. Now, these are different words now. Image. Think of in English. We have the word picture, image, likeness, whatever you want. One Hebrew, they got a lot of different words too. The word pesel, what does it mean? If you look up this word in the Hebrew Bible, every occurrence of the word pesel, in the Hebrew Bible, there's about, I don't know, about 20 or 30 of them. I can't remember off the top of my head. Every occurrence of this word, pesel or peselim, the plural, every occurrence is in reference to a pagan idol. It does not just mean image for a Hebrew speaker. It means an image of a pagan god. It is never used in any other way except in reference to the image of a pagan god. So in its root, yes, it means image. But in its use by the Hebrew people, it was not just the word image among a few other synonyms they had. This particular one was used to refer to the images of pagan gods. Now, in the Greek translation, we have a confirmation of this. There is the Septuagint. You probably have heard of this. The Septuagint is a Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures by Jews 200 years before Christ. This is a Jewish translation of the Hebrew scriptures into Greek 200 years before. Why did they do this? Well, because they weren't speaking Hebrew anymore, right? By this time, everything they're writing is in Greek. Think of the books of the Maccabees, the Book of Wisdom, even the place they worship on Saturday. It's called a synagogue, right? Synagogue. It's a Greek word. Greek was their language. This is why the early Christians, even the early Jewish Christians, wrote in Greek. It was the language of the Jews of the Mediterranean diaspora, even in Jerusalem. Okay, so when they translated their scriptures from Hebrew into Greek so that people could read it and understand it in their synagogues, they translated it into the Greek word. So pesel gets translated as the Greek word. Oops, got there. Idolon. 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 Now, you probably can figure out enough. Oh, the ending there, on, is just the neuter ending. So, idol is the root. Idol. Now, what English word comes from that? Idol. 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 And thank God there are a couple English translations out there today that actually put the word idol here. This is what it is. What's an idol in modern English? In modern English, idol is an image of a pagan god. There you go. Image of a pagan god that people are going to worship. And that's exactly, if you look at the context here, look at verse 5, and you look at the previous verses, that's exactly what's going on. This is not only what you find in a couple of good English translations today, but that's what the Jews used to translate it as in the Greek, and that's their meaning of the word in the Hebrew. And this is how they understood it. Go to a synagogue today. You know what you're going to find in a synagogue? You'll find stained glass windows and images all over the walls of the stories of salvation history with Moses and all sorts of stuff, and Abraham. There's a beautiful Greek Orthodox church in Omaha, Nebraska. Father Seraphim, you've probably been there, haven't you? And I remember I went in there one time for a church tour at a food festival. And a gorgeous church, beautiful dome. Went in there, and I looked up, and there up in the dome, in the glass, were stained glass windows of Abraham, I think, and Moses. I can't remember what it was. No, I'm sorry. It's David with a harp. And so it's David with a harp and Moses with the Ten Commandments. And I said to the deacon who was giving the church tour, I said, those are really interesting stained glass windows up there. They just don't seem to fit the rest of the artwork in here. He said, oh, yeah, that's because we bought this church. This was a synagogue. And when we bought it, we kept those because we thought they were nice, and they, you know, kind of kept the history of the fact that this was originally a synagogue and now it's a Greek Orthodox church. I said, oh, that's nice. But here's these stained glass windows of David with a harp and Moses getting the Ten Commandments. They have no problem with images. If you go in the first, if you go on archaeological digs in Jerusalem and Israel, and they're digging up places of worship, when they figure out it's a place of worship, the first question is it Christian or Jewish? And the only way they can tell really is which way it's facing. If it's facing east, they know it's Christian. If it's facing Jerusalem, they know it's a Jewish synagogue. But the artwork in this inside is for the most part all the same. It's the imagery of what you and I would call the Old Testament. Mosaics on the floor and on the walls of Moses and the cross in the Red Sea and all that stuff. Okay. So the Jews understand, even modern Jews understand this verse in the way I'm explaining it to you, and the way that the ancient Jews understood it, in the way that Christians have historically understood it. And that is, it's a condemnation of the making of pagan idols. Tragically, due to Muhammad's influence and misunderstanding of the text, influence on Christianity, and then also Calvin's misunderstanding of the text, there have been a lot of moments of confusion in the history of Christianity the last 1,000 years. Due to this. All right, so now, what can we find outside of this text? We already talked about the immediate historical and literary context. Let's go outside the text and find out what makes most sense here. I think you already know what does, but let's just confirm that. Let's turn over to Exodus chapter, in Exodus chapter 20, Exodus chapter 20, verse 23, look what God says. This is chapter 20, verse 23, same chapter. You shall not make gods of silver to be with me, nor shall you make for yourselves gods of gold. Look at that. In the very same chapter, a condemnation of making pagan idols. All right, now, chapter 25. After they all agreed to the covenant, that is the contract, that they would do what God says, and he'll do everything, they're all happy. They both signed off on the contract. Then God says, okay, we're going to live together now. God is going to come dwell on the earth again, right? This is a restoration of Eden in a certain extent. God's going to dwell among man, among his people, who are going to abide in his word. And so now, in chapter 25, he gives them the description of how he's going to make the place for him to dwell. This is his tent. The people of Israel are dwelling in a tent. God's going to dwell in a tent, right? They're out in there, they're at Mount Sinai. So he says, verse 8, let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell in their midst. Notice the purpose of the meeting tent is not a place for sacrifice. It is a place where God and man may dwell together, where God may dwell among man. And therefore, as we'll see, it's a place where they'll offer sacrifice. It's very important to understand that order of importance here. Okay, so now in chapter 25, verse 8, let them make me a sanctuary where I dwell in their midst. And then now he tells them how to make it. And look at the first thing they're going to make. The first thing is where God's going to sit. This is his throne. It's called the Ark of the Covenant. It's an acacia wood box. Why acacia wood? Because that's the only wood at Mount Sinai. There's just scrub trees. So they take this acacia wood box, little desert trees, and they make some wood out of it. They make some little boards out of it. And then they're going to make a box. And then the box is going to be plated on the inside and outside with gold. Make it nice and pretty. And then they're going to put the Ten Commandments in there, the stone tablets. You know this. You've probably seen the Indiana Jones. And then on top of there is going to be a plank, a lid out of gold. And on top of the lid is going to be, it says this, verse 17, you shall make for me a mercy seat of pure gold. 2 cubits and a half shall be its length, and 1.5 cubits its breadth. Cubit is about 1.5 feet. And you shall make 2 cherubim of gold of a hammered work, shall you make them on 2 ends of the mercy seat. Verse 20, the cherubim shall spread out their wings above, overshadowing the mercy seat. Verse 22, there I will meet with you from above the mercy seat, from between the 2 cherubim that are upon the Ark of the Testimony. I will speak with you all that I will give you in commandment for the people of Israel. Now, if God condemned the making of religious imagery back in chapter 20, verse 4, we now have a schizophrenic God. Okay, he's saying one thing, and now he's saying complete opposite. But we don't have a schizophrenic God. We have a God that is immutable. He does not change. He always says and does the same thing. So the problem is people's misread of chapter 20, verse 4. Here we find God telling Moses to not only make a box to put the Ten Commandments in, which has that commandment about the images, but upon it is going to be a lid with 2 cherubim. Don't you think of some overweight little Gerber babies with wings? Okay, that's pagan Cupid. That's imagery from late Renaissance, borrowing of the god Cupid. Little cherubim. You want to see a cherub, what a cherub would look like? Go look at Ezekiel chapter 1, a ferocious animal with wings outspread. And over those wings, God's going to rest. And he's going to talk to, this is his seat. This is his throne. This is his throne room. This is his palace. And he's going to rest on the box that has the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments is what unites heaven and earth, God to man. And this is a foreshadowing, of course, of the most holy Theotokos, the Ark of the Covenant and the New Covenant in the flesh, who will have in her the Word of God in the flesh. We've talked about that elsewhere. We'll talk about it another time. Okay. So as we continue to read in the description of the meeting tent, chapter 26, verse 1, the curtains are going to be embroidered with cherubim. Again, don't think of overweight Gerber baby's wings. Chapter 26, verse 31, and you shall make a veil of blue and purple and scarlet stuff and fine linen and skilled work with cherubim. As you keep reading, chapter 28, the high priest, he's going to be, his garments, verse 31 and following, are going to be decorated with bells and pomegranates. Pomegranates because the image of fertility, life. seeds. Okay, that is the place where God will, this is, and God gave these directions. This isn't Moses making this stuff up from his idea of pagan idols or temples in Egypt. God's telling, make it according to the pattern I tell you. And here is how you're going to do it. This is not the only place you see this kind of imagery. Turn over to 1 Kings chapter 6. 1 Kings chapter 6. If you don't have the books of, or if you have, let's see, this would be 1 Kings. Yeah, no matter, if you have four books of Kings, then this would be 3 Kings. If you have a King James Bible or Douay Rheims or one that's following the Septuagint naming. Okay, so this is 1 Kings chapter 6 or 3 Kings if you have a 3 Kings. 1 Kings chapter 6. Solomon is building the temple. They're in Jerusalem. Now there's going to be a permanent place where God's going to dwell among them. They were dwelling in tents, so God was in a tent. It had to be easy to move. Now they're in permanent locations. Their houses are built of stone, so God's house is going to be built out of stone. And so now you have the story in chapter 6 of 1 Kings. Again, look at this language, chapter 6, verse 11. Now the word of the Lord came to Solomon concerning this house which you are building. If you will walk in my statutes, obey my ordinances, and keep all my commandments, and walk in, then I will establish my word with you, which I spoke to David your father, and I will dwell among the children of Israel. Right? You can hear the exact same language we heard back in Exodus chapter 24, verse 8. The purpose of the temple is not to have a place where there will be an altar to sacrifice to God. It's not even inside the building. It's outside the building. Okay, there's lots of smoke there. The purpose of the temple is to be a place where God will dwell among his people. It's a house for God. And outside the front door is the place to sacrifice them. Okay, so this is a place where God will dwell among his people. All right, so then as we hear the description, Solomon's description here, the author here describes first the most important place, the Holy of Holies. And he's going to start with the Holy of Holies. He didn't have to start with the ark now because the ark's already made. So God's throne's already there. It's already made. But the place where it will be housed is going to be a new Holy of Holies, no longer a goatskin Holy of Holies. Now it's going to be on a stone. And so the description of that is in verse 14 following. Made out of stone, and then it's lined with cedar, and then lined with gold. Very beautiful. And then it's also embroidered or imprinted with the image of gourds. This is verse 18. Gourds, again, image of fertility. Flowers. Image of fertility, life. As you keep reading, verse 29, the walls were carved with cherubim, palm trees, flowers. You can keep reading, you can see all this stuff. But I want you to focus here now on verse 23, on two 15-foot statues of cherubim. Cherubim, plural. Cherub, singular, cherubim. Okay, so two cherubs. Two ferocious angelic creatures guarding the Holy of Holies. These are Solomon's large versions of the little ones that are on top of the ark. Everything that Moses made was small and easy to carry. They were going through the wilderness. Here, everything's permanent. So everything Moses makes is big and heavy. So now you have 15-foot statues made out of olive wood and then covered in gold. And they're placed on either side of the ark in the Holy of Holies. Huge wings outstretched. As you keep reading, you hear about, again, verse 29, cherubim, palm trees, open flowers. Verse 32, palm trees, open flowers. Verse 35, cherubim, palm trees, open flowers. I could go on and on. Chapter 7, pomegranates, lots of them. Verse 20, 200 pomegranates. And then look at this. This is great. Verse 23. Moses made basically a little spaghetti pot for the people, the priests, to wash their hands in when they came out of the meeting tent and walked to the altar and back. But this is everything's bigger in Solomon's temple. This is the size of about a backyard above ground pool, doughboy pool, 10,000 gallons. It's the bath of purity. The priest would actually bathe in it. And this is verse 23. Then he made the molten sea. It was round 10 cubits from the brim to the brim. And it was resting, verse 25, on 12 oxen. These are not living oxen. These are fashioned out of bronze. Remember that golden calf back in Exodus 32? Clearly, God doesn't have a problem with the making of an image of a calf or an ox, okay? It's what is your purpose of that image? Is it the image of a false god, like the god Apis of Egypt, the golden calf, Mexico, or is it an image of the 12 tribes of Israel, which in this case, this bath of purity is held up on the backs of 12 life-size oxen that represent the 12 tribes of Israel. It goes on. Verse 29, the walls of the room paneled with lions, oxen, cherubim. Verse 36, cherubim, lions, palm trees, flower. I could go on. Okay, so what's going on here? Obviously, God does not condemn the making of religious imagery. If you keep reading here in chapter 8, he likes the place. His glory cloud fills it. This is, you can read about this in chapter 8, verse 6 through 11. His glory cloud fills the place, just like it filled the tent that Moses had made back in chapter 40, verse 34 and 35 of the book of Exodus. So, obviously, God does not have a problem with religious imagery. In fact, he demands it to be made. Why? Does he need it? No, he doesn't need it. We need it. He doesn't need anything. We need it. We need to see it to understand that the cherubim that surround his glorious throne that we cannot see with our physical eyes are there. And we need to watch out and be careful. Those physical images, this is what the Seventh Ecumenical Council said, that the images that are in our churches are intended to help us see the things we cannot see. They help us, they remind us of something that we can't see with our physical eyes. Okay, now, so it's catechetical. Here's some other really interesting images as well about this, some related to this. Turn with me to Numbers 21. Numbers 20. So those are catechetical images. Someone say, okay, well, those are decorations. Those are decorations. Yeah, more than just decorations. They have a catechetical purpose. But look at this. Look at Numbers chapter 21. Numbers chapter 21. The people of Israel out in the wilderness. And as you find in every chapter of the book of Numbers, they've rebelled against God. So he sends among them fiery serpents, probably asps, a venomous snake in the region. Fiery, not that they were actually on fire, but probably in reference to the feeling when they bit, a burning sensation, or maybe the fever that came with it or something. Who knows? Okay, in chapter 21, the people rebelled, and he sent among them these snakes into the camp to bite them as a chastisement. Really, what happens is they've moved away from God, and he is there out away from his protection. The serpents now come in. That's really what's happening here. In verse 5, and the people spoke against God, against Moses, why have you brought us out of Egypt to die in this wilderness? There is no food. So the serpents come in and bite them. Verse 7, and the people came to Moses and said, we have sinned, for we have spoken against the Lord and against you. Pray to the Lord that he take away the serpents from us. So Moses prayed for the people. This is verse 8. And the Lord said to Moses, make a fiery serpent, an image of one, and set it on a pole. And everyone who is bitten, when he sees it, shall live. So Moses made a bronze serpent. and set it on a pole. And if a serpent bit any man, he would look at the bronze serpent and live. Not only does God command this image be made, but Jesus uses this image in John chapter 3 for his own salvation that he will work among his people. As Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up. So clearly, God doesn't have a problem with religious imagery here. Not only does he command that it be made in the places where he's going to dwell on earth for the sake of his people, but he even commands one to be made and through it saves his people, and it becomes a type of the salvation of Jesus in the new covenant. There is no possible way Muhammad or Calvin properly read Exodus chapter 20, verse 4. Now, what does Exodus chapter 20, verse 4 condemn? Well, the making of idols, the making of the images of false gods. And in fact, in this very text, we have a problem, not in what God commands, but in what we do with what God does. Right? There was no problem with the fruit in the garden. The problem was in what we do with what God gives us. So often we take the gifts of God and turn them into idols. Does that mean that he should not give us gifts? Oh, no. But it means that we need to direct our understanding to the one who gives it to us. Right? The all of creation was intended to be the great sacrament, the mystery through which we would experience the unknowable God, right? We know God who is unknowable through what is knowable, that is what he has done, right? We can know him not in his essence, but in his energies, in his energia, in his works, right? When we look at creation, we take the creation that is intended to be the thing through which we come to understand and know God and turn it into an idol, an end in itself, like Adam in the garden with the fruit, then we fall into the same sin. As St. Paul says, all of our sins, though different in the end, really of the same nature, right? All sin is idolatry. So what did they do with this serpent that had been made, this snake? You turn over to 2 Kings chapter 18. 2 Kings chapter 18. By the time we get to King Hezekiah, who is a monotheist, very rare among the kings of the line of David, the monotheist, David, Asa, Hezekiah, and Josias, right? But Asa wasn't all that strong of a character, so he doesn't make it into the great three in the book of Sirach. David, Hezekiah, and Josias. Okay, Hezekiah cleansed the temple of its pagan idols that had been accumulated into the building and all the other things. He did but one of the other things he did was he had to, look at this, this is chapter 18, verse 4, 2 Kings, chapter 18, verse 4, or if you have four books of Kings, this is 4th Kings, chapter 18, verse 4. He removed the high places, broke the pillars, cut down the Asherah, these are all pagan images, and he broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made, for until those days the people of Israel had burned incense to it. They worshipped it as a pagan god. They called it Nehushtan, the serpent god. Now, someone might turn to it and say, look at that. You see, so maybe they shouldn't have had the thing in the first place. No, hold on. So maybe God shouldn't have told Moses to command. Are you smarter than God? No, maybe God shouldn't have made the fruit in the garden then, really, because Adam misused it. Really, maybe God shouldn't have created creation because how we misuse it. It's irrational, right? So God makes, everything that God makes is good, very good, Genesis chapter 1. Regardless of what we do with it, it is still good because it's made by the one who is good. And then we can take it and destroy it and misuse it. Yeah, that's our stupidity. That's our fallen way. Okay, so in chapter 18, there you have God tells them to make this beautiful image through which he will save the people, and through which Jesus then uses an image of his own salvation he will bring among the people through the cross. But the people, in between Moses making it and Jesus referring to it, the people abused it. That's what they do with it? They turn it into a pagan idol, the image of the serpent god. Other examples of this that you probably know well, think of Exodus chapter 32. Exodus chapter 32, a passage that is often misread by those who follow Calvin's misreading of Exodus 20. To try and make sense out of Exodus 20 and Exodus 32 as a Calvinist, you got to then, if you're going to misread chapter 20, you got to misread it 32. But if you read 32 carefully, you're going to see what's going on here. When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, when he'd gone back up the mountain, he was getting the directions to how to make the tabernacle, and the people gathered to themselves to Aaron, and they said, "Get up, make us gods." In Hebrew, the word is Elohim. In Hebrew, normally the word for God is in the plural. It's by context, you know, whether in English it should be singular or plural. In this particular case, probably singular would be better. But make us a God who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. Aaron said to them, take off the rings of gold which are in your ears, your wives' ears, your sons, your daughters, and bring them to me. So all the people took off the rings of gold which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. Now, what was that gold? Where did they get that gold? Do you remember? God told them to ask the Egyptians for their gold. Why would they need gold? Because someday they're going to need it to build the beautiful tabernacle where he would dwell among the people. So the very gold that he caused the Egyptians to give to them so they'd have something to give back to him, they're going to now give to a demon, right? The god Apis, to make the pagan idol. So it says, and he received the gold from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool, a carving tool, and made a molten calf. And they said, they said, this is the god, or English translations, these are the gods, because you get plural in the Hebrew. O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. Whoops. Remember chapter 20, verse 2 and 3? This is the God, or these are the gods, who brought you up out of Egypt. When Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made proclamation and said, tomorrow shall be a feast to Yahweh. Okay, what's Aaron doing? If you read St. Ephrem, the Syrian on this, St. Ephrem, most thorough patristic commentary on Genesis, Aaron's trying to stall the people. They're about ready to take off. They're going to just leave Moses up there in the mountain in the clouds, in the smoke. They're going to just go. They're going to go back to Egypt. So Aaron decides to stall them. And what he does to stall them is he makes a god they're going to recognize, the image of the god Apis, one of the gods of Egypt, a fertility cult. I don't think I have to get in the description of how they celebrated the liturgy. And so Aaron did that to stall them. But then he says, tomorrow we're going to celebrate Yahweh, okay? Guys, remember that guy? Remember the one that really brought you out of Egypt? Guys, remember him? Remember, please? And they rose up early in the morrow and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. That's a euphemism for the fertility liturgy. I won't get into the details for the young ears among us. Verse 7, and the Lord said to Moses, go down, for your people. Remember that language? I am your God. Remember that language? Whoop, that language is gone. Your people. They're no longer his people. Your people, whom you brought out of the land of Egypt, have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them, They have made for themselves a molten calf and have worshipped it and have sacrificed to it. And it said, this is the God, O Israel, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Uh-oh. They turned to pagan idolatry. What idol? The image of the god Apis. Okay, so write down for yourself, right there in the spot where you have the image of the word calf, put Jeremiah 46, 13 to 17. Jeremiah 46, 13 to 17. There you have a reference to it. Any commentary written by anyone with a PhD in biblical studies will tell you. This is a reference to the Egyptian god. Check an Egyptologist. They'll tell you the same thing. Any Egyptologist. This is the image of the god Apis, one of the gods of Egypt, one that apparently the Israelites had a hankering for. Okay. Now, some other examples of the making of pagan idols that is condemned by Exodus 20, verse 4. Turn over with me to Daniel chapter 3. Daniel chapter 3. You probably know this story well. Daniel chapter 3. Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. You remember that. He had that dream about the huge statue with the different parts, and no one could figure out what it meant. And Daniel comes in and says, this is the history of the empires. The first part of the statue, the head of gold, is you, Nebuchadnezzar, and your kingdom. The second part is the kingdom that will come after you, which, as you know, the bust or the chest of silver with two arms, that's the Medo-Persian Empire. And then the belly of bronze, that's the Greek Empire. And then the legs of iron, that's the Roman Empire. And during the time of the Roman Empire, the kingdom of God is established, a little stone that was not cut out by human hands. Okay, that's Nebuchadnezzar's dream. It's very similar to Daniel's dream in chapter 7. Nebuchadnezzar then says, I have a great idea. So what he does is he makes a massive statue, all of gold, in chapter 3. Not just the head of gold. The whole thing's made out of gold, from the head to the feet, right? Implying that somehow his kingdom will last forever. Historians suggest that there may be an actual historical event that is connected to this. Not just him making this, but to Nebuchadnezzar's reinstitution of the worship of Marduk, the god of the Babylonians. Marduk was the main god of the Babylonians in previous generations, but he had fallen out of favor. He had been overshadowed by many other gods that the Babylonians were now worshiping, all the different gods of the different kingdoms they had conquered. And so Marduk was just, on the back of the shelf collecting dust. So what Nebuchadnezzar does, he brings Marduk back to the front of the shelf and says, no, we're all going to worship him. He's our main god again, the god of Babylon, not the god of all these other nations, all these other gods. So there may be this making of the statue, this may be the god Marduk. But again, this is beyond what we can do in a study like this for all the details. But okay, So he says in chapter 3, he makes this image, and then he says, this is verse 4, and he herald proclaimed aloud, you are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, the pipe, the lyre, the trigon, the harp, the bagpipe, the guitar, the organ, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image of the king Nebuchadnezzar set up before. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast in the fire first. Therefore, as soon as all the people heard the sound of the horn and the pipe, all the people, nations, fell down and worshiped the golden image. Verse 8. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came and said, Nebuchadnezzar, there's a couple guys here who aren't following the rules. A couple of those Jews you gave some high places to, we don't like them. And so verse 10, you, O king, have made a decree that every man, when he hears it, fall down and worship. Verse 11, but there are Jews who don't do these things. These men, O king, pay no heed to you. This is verse 12. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image you have set up. That's a Semitism. It's synonymous parallelism, same thing. They do not worship your gods. They don't serve your gods or worship the golden image. That's a Semitism. This is how their language works. Same thing. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. And they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar said to them, is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image I have set up? Now, if you are ready, when you hear the sound of all these musical instruments, which I have made, you will fall down and worship the image which I have made, well and good. But if not, if you do not worship, you shall be immediately cast in the fire furnace. Verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If it be so, our God, look what this is. This is not a debate about whether or not you should be making religious imagery. This is a debate about whether you should worship the one true God or the false gods of the nations, which, of course, is what Exodus chapter 20, verses 1 through 5, 6 were all about, right? Okay, so if it be so, our God whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fire furnace. And if he will not deliver us out of your hand, O king, and he will deliver us out of your king, but if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image you have set up. Again, it's not prose. This is what we're talking about here. This is what we're talking about. Exodus chapter 20, verse 4, is a condemnation of the worship of false gods, which in the ancient world came in the form of idolatry, that is, making of images of false gods and worshiping them. That's what it's about. If you read the Bible from the beginning to the end, really in the end, this is the theme. Are you going to have relationship with the one true God, your loving Father who created you? Or are you going to turn and worship the creature instead of the creator? As St. Paul says in Romans chapter 1. This is what it's about. Are you going to turn toward your source of life or away from it, as Adam did in the garden? That's what Exodus chapter 20, verse 4 is about. And in the end, that theme of salvation history is what we will be celebrating this Sunday as we celebrate the triumph of Orthodoxy. Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit, both now and ever, and to age of ages. Amen.